Welcome back to this week's Fear or Favour. So another eclectic mix, lots gone on in the crime world this week. Let's start with Wayne Cousins. So he was convicted, as we know, of the murder of Sarah Everard, and he and his legal team have been fighting to try and have his sentence reduced. What do you make of this, Nazir?
We've spoken before about how terrible this crime was. A serving police officer using, well, he wasn't on duty, but he used all the tools of a police officer to abduct her, rape her, and murder Sarah. And then the aftermath, which was quite terrible, really, how the police responded or didn't respond to the concerns of the communities of this country. This, the judge made a whole life order. Historically, to give you some context, ministers used to make those orders. They would decide what cases were so heinous that the convicted person should never leave prison. That was changed so that judges make that decision. And invariably, they use it in very, very high-profile cases, terrorism usually, that type of thing.
And in fact, Cousins is the first person for a single murder.
Absolutely. I prosecuted Dale Cregan, who murdered two Manchester police officers. He got a whole life order. And the point that the Wayne Cousins' solicitors, lawyers, are trying to make is, as you just said, that one murder should not be sufficient for the convicted person to have to spend the rest of his life in prison. The judge's decision was based on the fact, as I said, that it damaged confidence in policing and so much that the appropriate sentence was a whole life order. So the Court of Appeal are looking at this. They're looking at other cases as well where whole life orders have been given in order to, I hope, send out a judgment that gives some clarity. But as I said, in this particular case, I can't really argue against a whole life order. I don't think anybody can. Yes, it was one case, but it was this case. And we all remember how damaging it was to confidence in policing. It still is. There are loads of people who are now reluctant to engage with the police where previously they would have been because of their concerns over this. Remember, the police were telling us to, or telling victims or potential victims to, flag down buses and taxis, and also the police were told to switch on their radio so that the person they're dealing with could check with the operations room that this officer was genuinely on duty. All of that stemmed from this case, so it had such an impact that a whole life order was thought, and is thought, and remains to be, in my view, correct in these circumstances.
What do you think? So 64 people currently in jail, England and Wales, for whole life orders. What do you think about the balance between rehabilitation, punitive effect? I mean, do you think there are certain crimes where whole life order is the only option and they have to go to jail for the rest of their life?
I think so. We quite rightly got rid of the capital penalty in the mid-60s, but we replaced it with this, that life should mean life for some people. 54 out of 90,000 in prison is a small number, a very small number. It's really hard for those of in prison officers to manage these people because, of course, you know, generally, the whole point of license, i.e. people leaving before the termination of their sentence, is to manage their behavior. But if you're never going to leave, if you're only going to leave in a coffin, well, it's really difficult to have any disciplinary processes in place. So they're very hard to manage generally. But as I said, it's a very small number of cases. It reflects public horror at certain crimes. It also responds to those people, and there's still a sizable minority in this country who believe that there should be the death penalty. It gives, it deals with that issue too. So I don't see anything wrong with it as is, when it's appropriately used and appropriately tested and appealed against, as in this case.
Let's talk a little bit about prisons. So the whole, I know we're going to do a feature on prisons in due course, but the whole element of sending someone to prison has to have a punitive effect, but there also has to be a restorative element, because otherwise people come out of jail and just go and commit further offences. The massive problem, of course, is that prisons are full, and therefore the ability to go into prison and get treatment there is not the resources within prison to enable that to happen.
As we'll discuss in a future podcast, absolutely. You know, we often call prison the revolving door. You know, offenders go in, they spend a bit of time, they're locked away for 23 hours a day in a room. They come out, they reoffend, they go back in, they reoffend, they come out. It's this constant revolving door, and we haven't got prison right at all. Despite people thinking prison works, it doesn't work because why do people reoffend? Loads of them do. You've seen it. I've seen it in a courtroom. I used to over my 25 years, I've no doubt there are a handful of people that I prosecuted so many times. You know, they've gone to prison, they come out and reoffend, and here they come again. You know? Well, if prison worked, that wouldn't happen. So the rehabilitation in prison, it's no fault of the prison authorities. They don't, as you said a moment ago, they're not resourced to do so. There is some good work. I mean, there are some brilliant charities that do some excellent work in this field and trying to rehabilitate. Coaching in Style, for example. Style is a prison in Cheshire, a women's prison, an organization that I know very well, has worked very well with those women who are in prison, and many of them, the evidence shows, will never go back to prison the way they've been supported.
Do you think some of the wrong people are in prison? I mean, my worry is prison has an effect, and of course it's important to keep the dangerous people out, but prisons are so overcrowded. Could we not just do it better? Could we not bring more people out of jail and perhaps get them to do community-based services, which are effective?
That was, governments after governments have always said that we're really keen, or they're really keen on rehabilitation and restorative justice, and keeping some people out of prison, for low-level offending. If you're going to send somebody to prison for less than 12 months, you shouldn't bother, because the moment they go in, they're ready to come out, and all you've given is a little bit of a respite, maybe to the shop they're stealing from or something. You know, it doesn't do anything what it should do. So I think there are certain things that governments can do, which is to reduce the prison population in relation to those lesser offenders, provide them with the kinds of treatment they may need, because they're often drug offended or alcohol or they're broken homes, or they've got domestic abuse, all those kinds of issues that impact on them, which lead them down the path of crime, all of which can be treated outside of prison rather than wasting precious prison space.
And I think there's an awful lot of women in jail who shouldn't be in jail.
I agree. I mean, 10% of the prison population is women, and you know the vast majority. I mean, there's several dozen in prison for like not paying their TV license or council tax, you know. Whereas you know and I know there are billionaires that are avoiding billions in tax, and we give them honours. So it really doesn't make any sense to put particularly mothers. If it's low-level offending, mothers, what happens is their children are taken into care. If they don't have another family, the children themselves, some of them unfortunately end up in crime themselves. It's an endless spiral, isn't it? And we can find ways of reducing the population without harming the community, without leading to further crime, ultimately saving millions and billions ultimately, but also protecting our communities.
And it is very often about breaking a cycle, isn't it? It's about enabling people to have the opportunity to step off that conveyor belt and see something different in life that gives them different opportunities. It means that they don't have to go to crime in order to survive.
Absolutely that. They don't know anything different. I mean, and they are, they've grown up potentially in families or communities where crime is just so common. They're often groomed into crime in some ways, and there has to be an opportunity for them somewhere down the line for somebody to take them aside and work with them so that they don't carry on for the rest of their lives committing crimes and ultimately harming themselves and others. So there are approaches that we know would work, but it requires a strategy that would make it happen, and I don't see one right now.
No, well, then nobody's interested in doing it. There's a lot of talk, and there has been for years, but there's actually done
it. It is only talk, you're right.
So let's talk a little bit. We've talked about this, and we raised this early on as a concern, and it was a real concern that we both discussed about Ukrainian refugees coming over here and being exploited. Those very people who are saying that, oh, we can put them up in a house, exploiting them. And we've now seen evidence of that. There was a recent research that was done, which identified and showed that there were vulnerable refugees coming over to the UK, and they were being specifically targeted by men who had an interest in violence or sexual abuse. And as a result of that, these Ukrainian refugees have come over here and have been abused. Now, the Home Office is saying, well, there's very careful checks, safeguarding checks in place. But the reality is that a lot of these refugees are using Facebook groups, which are outside of those checkpoints. And people are obviously getting contact with them and then offering them the place in their house. Yes, OK, they don't get the money sign up, but they do get the opportunity of a Ukrainian refugee coming over here with where the risks exist. This is a real problem.
Yeah, we flagged it, everybody flagged it up. Isn't it shocking that once again, you know, this is not news. We knew this was going to happen. What tends to happen is the offenders, the criminal gangs usually, and criminals generally, look for people to exploit. And what better person to exploit than somebody that's lost everything? That is now in a foreign country, potentially probably not speaking the language, with no income, with no support, with no family support, often having lost loved ones. They are the most vulnerable you can possibly imagine. And the offenders seek them out. Mm-hmm. You know, they live for this moment. And as a consequence, you know, the danger is enormous. And yes, all right, the Home Office keep telling us about we'll vet them. And
but they, you're absolutely right. But the problem is, of course, these very women are the women who are the most vulnerable. I mean, there's a dating site on Facebook called Single Ukrainian Women. You know, it's so open to abuse is that.
Yeah. Well, you know, Eastern European women and, you know, Ukraine is Eastern European, have regularly been targeted. I remember a few years back when I was in Rome, we did a conference on airport crime. And one of the things I learned was that there were slave auctions taking place at Gatwick Airport. What was happening is that Eastern European women and others were coming off the plane, and these groups of brothel keepers or pimps or whatever you want to call them were there bidding for whichever girl came off the plane, and then taking them away, whisking them off, and putting them in the sex industry, whether taking their passports off them, et cetera, which we know happens. And so is it any surprise that these offenders have got rich pickings, literally? And we have, once again, we're playing catch up, trying to catch them out when we could have put things in place at the outset, which prevented any of them coming to harm.
Yeah. And of course, that sexual exploitation of women, it continues. And when they're the most vulnerable, which they will be when they're coming from Ukraine, it's open to exploitation, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And money, you know, you can make money out of people's misery. And, you know, that's what drives criminals generally. And so it's not the sex, it's the fact that they can make enormous sums of money out of this. And we had opportunities to put things in place that would prevent any of this happening. But now I'm afraid we're dealing with the consequences.
Something that's under big consideration in the United States is this issue of legal abortions, the Roe versus Wade. And this is an issue that's really coming up and being discussed with Congress. You know, is it right that abortion should be allowed? Is if it gets through Congress, and there's quite a long way for it to go. What's your thoughts around that? I mean, it's a very delicate area, isn't it?
Yes and no. You know, I'm very much a pro-choice. You know, I can do whatever I like with my body. Mark, you can do whatever I like with yours. Martin, our producer, can do whatever he likes with his. But why is it that we expect women to do our bidding? You know, somehow their choices are limited by whatever it is that men choose to do. What, you know, if there was a law that said we all ought to have a vasectomy, for example, and which can be reversed if we want children, you want to bet your bottom dollar that we'd be up in arms. Us men would be on the street with our placards fighting tooth and nail for this to be brought in. The whole point of Roe and Wade, the American debate right now, it was settled. We all thought it was settled law. You know, the Supreme Court 40, 50 years ago decided that you know, it's a constitutional right to be able to look after your own body and make your own choices. It shouldn't be left to states to legislate. What we are now discussing is that the Supreme Court, in an extraordinary leak, actually, of a draft judgment, I can't think of one in history, actually, of such a thing happening, have leaked a majority, appears to be, well, it is a majority opinion, that would have decided that Roe versus Wade should no longer be settled law, which goes against what the Supreme Court justices said when they were giving evidence during their selection process in effect. But anyway, that's by the by. And what this means, ostensibly, is there's been real pushback in recent years, particularly in southern American states, where Trump and the GOP and some of the religious extremists are quite strong. And they have been pushing back on the ability of women to make this choice. They're making it really, really difficult. And what the Supreme Court judgment would do is it would say, right, you don't no longer have a federal constitutional right. It's up to the states to make a decision. Well, given the states are deciding to close down clinics, making it extraordinarily difficult, you can't have an abortion post X number of weeks, all those kinds of things, it's very, very likely to lead to tens of thousands, if not millions of American women suddenly not having the ability to terminate, even in ectopic cases. I mean, I saw one particular American politicians saying even a fetus that's in an ectopic pregnancy, which by the way is not survivable at all, but could ultimately kill the mother, even that should not be aborted in any way, shape or form. It's really got to stage. Well, I tweeted about this. My point was, the Americans have spent, in their view, two decades fighting religious extremism around the world. Millions of people have died as a result of this, and yet religious extremists in the United States appear to be able to change the laws to bring in their way of thinking and deny women substantially recognized rights across the world. And we've got to recognize, somebody said the other day, hang on a minute, you Muslims don't, you're worse than we are. Strange as it may sound, and here's a bit of theology for you, terminations or abortions are legal in Islam until about the fourth month. So even in Islamic countries, which, the United States was considered uncivilized, quote unquote, some of them anyway, they are very much more civilized when it comes to the issue of women being able to terminate their babies, their fetuses, and prevent them from having to be, I don't know, what the expectation is. I mean, they're talking about they should be adopted. Whereas nobody in America wants to adopt these babies when they're born, even when they're born of rape. They're saying, well, no, you should carry on and go through the whole pregnancy and then look at your child, knowing that it's come from a particular rapist. It's a scandal to me. And we're at only the beginning of this debate. I have no doubt there are months ahead which will be really real turmoil for the Americans. But worldwide, we need to keep an eye on this, because there's been a substantial pushback, as we've discussed before, on women's rights and the women's right to choose. And we've got to draw a line in the sand and say what is acceptable and what isn't.
Yeah, and I think so many problems with legislation, it's legislations created by men rather than women, for women.
Always. I mean, the Americans, because of the, I like the idea of a written constitution, even for this country, for the UK. But yeah, they're trying to read into a 200-year-old document things that were never contemplated. But the document itself was drawn up by men. And the strangest thing is the First Amendment to the American Constitution says that no religion should be given established position in the United States. Everybody should be free to carry, to do whatever religion they want, but there should be no one religion for the United States of America. That's in their own constitution. Somehow, many of these, I use the word bigots, have forgotten what their own constitution says about the place for religion. Keep religion out of the lawmaking. That's what the constitutional founding fathers said, and I stand by them. I'm very supportive of what the founding fathers said on this issue 220 years ago.
Metropolitan Police, we've talked about this lots of times. They're slowly drifting away as far as potential candidates. Lynn Owens has pulled herself away from it. We've now got Simon Burns, the PSNI chief. He's pulled himself away. It's leading a much shorter list, isn't it?
Yeah, I never expected Lynn. Lynn, phenomenal officer she is, has some serious health issues, so she stepped down from the National Crime Agency. I never expected Lynn to put her hat in the ring. Simon, I've known Simon from his days as chief constable in Cheshire, and then you know, Greater Manchester and other places, and now in PSNI, again, a very capable senior officer. And there will be others that will have put their name in the hat. But I'll go back to our, what we've discussed before, Mark. This job is undoable.
Yeah,
you know, I don't care if they had Iron Man or Captain America. You know, they would struggle in this job. You know. The London,
because it's just so unwieldy, because it's just so
it's ridiculous. 9, 10, 11 million people, 11 million people from all, you know, the most diverse city in the world, organized, you know, criminals are there, enormous amounts of money come in and out, criminal money comes in and out, there's enormous amounts of crime just because of the size of the population, and then you add in their additional responsibilities. Why do they remain responsible for terrorism? Why do they remain responsible for international crime? There are so many areas, quite frankly, which could happily be taken off them without without a blink of the eye. And then, of course, you know, I've said it before, I think it should be split into four districts, in effect, or four counties. So you have a northwest, southwest, etc., which is about 2.5 million people each, which is roughly the size of the second largest force. So that is much more manageable. It means that the police can focus on their communities rather than have to worry about all the political dimensions that are attached to the Metropolitan Commissioner's role. And you know, it's an absolute no-brainer. And here we are again, trying to recruit. For a role that will lead, I have no doubt whatsoever, to the early departure of whoever it is that's appointed.
So you think whoever comes in is not going to stay very long?
Doomed. They're doomed. Yeah, there hasn't been a, you know, going back 20, 25 years, commissioners have struggled. And most of them, I think all but one, didn't see out the whole of their contracted period. Yeah. And that, to my mind, tells you something about the role, doesn't it? It doesn't say about these individuals. These are the most prized police officers, but they can't do this job, and that will remain the case. You know, I wish whoever it is well. You know, people on social media asked me to apply, and you know, I couldn't think of something worse to do. I really do think that the job needs to be revisited, refined, and then maybe it will succeed. And that's not happening again. I don't know. I just get so pissed off about this because there, you know, everybody can see an answer, but somebody somewhere just can't grasp it and do something about it.
Let's talk a little bit about Twitter and harassment. As you know, this week I identified a troll who'd been harassing me for a period of time. And once they were identified and shown what they were really like, you know, they were very apologetic and issued a statement to correct that. Where do you think Twitter is? I mean, it's now Elon Musk has just spent his phenomenal amount of money that he does obviously doesn't care what he's got, really. I mean, he just how do you get rid of when you've got that much money? I think it's as simple as that. Yeah. But what do you think about him taking Twitter?
You know, I think he'll find it pretty unmanageable. We just talked about the commissioner's job. I think running Twitter is pretty unmanageable, particularly for one person. I mean, there's no way that, you know, the issues he's identified about, you know, a space for freedom of speech. Absolutely, I agree with that. And then he says we need to comply with the law. Yep, okay. Which law? Twitter operates in 208 countries. So which laws? Are you applying the Chinese freedom of speech or the French freedom of speech or the American freedom of speech? You know, so there are different laws on freedom of speech around the world, which makes that rather challenging. First thing that reactionary governments do during a protest is close down Twitter and other social media. So I think he's going to find it a pretty unmanageable mix. I love Twitter from the point of view of being able to engage with people that I wouldn't otherwise. You know, it's just, you know, it's also quite funny at times. I mean, it's not. We'll talk about your experience in a moment, which wasn't at all funny. But you know, generally, you see these, I don't know, the debates going on between, I don't know, Bette Midler and and some politician she's never ever heard of. You know, it's extraordinary how it's a pretty much of a leveler, really, between power and the less powerful being able to engage and have discussions about these things. So I think it'll be a struggle. I'll wait to see. I mean, one thing I would call for is an edit button.
Yes.
Yeah, so we can edit our tweets. You know, that tweet goes out and there's a spelling mistake and it's got 500 likes.
And there needs to be some kind of validity, doesn't there? Some kind of valid status in terms of setting up an account. I mean, my user had created an account. She had then gone on anonymously, and it took a fair amount of work to be able to find who she was. And, you know, when she was found and fully exposed, you know, backed off and went. But and there was clearly some mental health issues there because of the types of things that she was posting. And what ended up happening is she'd take posts that I'd posted and then added to them, put some really horrible personal details in there, which weren't true, but just made up. And the yeah. problem is, of course, is your family see it, your friends see it, and it impacts. And of course, what they then try to do is pull in other people to that, to try and then have a go at them. And connect it all together. And as you know, these things then other people pick up on and they go, is that true? What's that all about? And as soon as you get this public status, as soon as you get this public profile, people seem to think that you are a target.
You're fair acceptable. Game in their yeah. minds and their eyes. And as you say, mental health is an issue which we need to be mindful of. I'm very much in favour of getting rid of some of the anonymity or the perception of anonymity, because Twitter does know who you are.
Yeah.
Or should do, and then if they are doing what they did to you, then there should be a mechanism by which you find out pretty quickly who it is, and they can close them down, and you can take whatever action needs to be taken against them. At the moment, it's a bit of a battle on a regular basis. People hide behind, and there's the bots issue. You know,
yes.
You know, the fact is that if somebody attacks you, Mark, or me, or for that matter, the bots will join in, and suddenly it's magnified. And you know, yeah. you can—I've been there. You've been there. You can take it really personally, and it really affects your own mental health when you
yeah.
you see people saying stuff about you that's not true, and it's being magnified in that way. I think, but the point is, we are in the 21st century. We're not going to go back. If there wasn't a Twitter, there'd be something else similar. There was, wasn't there? It was a MySpace or God knows what it was.
You've been late, so.
You know, all those things. Friends reunited. You know, but the reality is there would have been something else, and there will be something else. We just need to, we've spoken about this before, educate people about how they use social media. And additionally, we need to police it, enforce it, so that those who do what they did to you and to me to some extent have consequences. And those consequences are meaningful consequences because, as you say, it can be, well, you know, you used to be able to lock the door on those strangers that want to attack you. Now they're on your system and there's no way of locking the door. And additionally, others who may not know you, but will see stuff about you and begin to think, hang on a minute, this might be true,
yeah.
even though it's absolute nonsense.
Words hurt.
Yeah, words, of course they do. And words have massive consequences. I mean, do you think that, you know, think about the dictators of this world, the Hitlers of this world. They relied upon words, you know? They didn't have to beat people up. They used the words to motivate people to commit harm, terrible harms. And so words have consequences. And I don't buy this thing that, you know, some sticks and stones, etc. The point is everything that damages and causes harm should have consequences. And people should be able to be free and able to report, to stand up, and ultimately to be, feel safe online. And we are now in a digital world and will be for forever now. So we've got to make it a much more safer place than it is.
So it's a slightly shorter one today, but let's just talk before we finish about Johnny Depp and Amber Heard. This is still ongoing, and actually it's moved back and forth, you're depending which camp you sit in, who you support, but it's pretty nasty, isn't it?
You know, it was never going to be not nasty. The allegations are, as we've said before, that either one or both are abusers in some way. Either one or both are victims in some way. This is a defamation trial, so this is basically, you know, Johnny Depp saying that Amber Heard has libeled him. Amber Heard saying that Johnny Depp has libeled her. It's a jury will make a judgment in due course. It is not nice to observe. You know, people are saying terrible things about each other. They're being backed up or not, as the case may be, by experts or by other witnesses that are really painting a picture of a very toxic relationship, the details of which continue to be staggering, really. But, you know, I think it's healthy in a society. I'm glad that they're streaming it because, you know, and I know that the media would always cut it out and exaggerate stuff, yes, or whatever true. It may be. You can watch it yourself and form your own view as to what's happening. I'm very concerned that people who have suffered domestic abuse might be re-triggered by all of this.
Yeah.
That's a real concern. And it's also interesting to see the PR battle that's going on. I don't know if you've been paying attention. You know, when I have a very quiet moment, I switch on my TikTok, and there you see little clips, and you see the Herd fans, and you see the Depp fans, and
there's quite a circus behind it, isn't there? There's quite a circus absolutely. Behind it.
But it's quite extraordinary. The trial is happening in Virginia because that's where the Washington Post is printed. So it's not happening in L.A. or New York where you'd expect the media circuit to be. So actually it's quite an interesting that there isn't the media circus at the venue that there would be had the trial taken place in some of the other more media circusy places. But, you know, at the end of the day, it comes down to the evidence being heard in that court and the cross-examination that continue to take place, and ultimately a jury will make a judgment based on what they've heard.
Yeah. Brilliant. Well, as ever, Nazir, brilliant to chat to you. It's great to catch up on the week's events. And please do tell your friends to keep listening to us. Do send us some messages. Tell us what you think of our podcast, and even drop us a line if you want us to talk about any specific subjects. Until next week, Nazir, look after yourself.
And you too. Bye now.
Thank you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this week's podcast. Do please tell your true crime friends, and it's important that you subscribe to our channel. If you've got any thoughts or you just simply want to get in touch, you can do so via our Twitter page, Fear or Favour, or go to our website, www.fearorfavour.com. The series is edited by Martin Kays, the music by Dylan Epega. Fear or Favour is an original true crime podcast in association with Audioboom.